Chapter 5, Open Book Management. Open book management is the best way I know of to keep people focused on the important issues facing the company. It takes down walls. When you communicate with people through financial statements, knowledge gets to them quickly without being distorted by internal rivalries. If everyone is looking at the whole business, it's much harder for departments to make excuses at another's expense. And when I say open, I mean open. A business should be run like an aquarium, where everybody can see what's going on, what's going in, what's moving around, what's coming out. You don't have to be in a situation like ours to benefit from open book management. It can work anywhere. You can practice it if you're a frontline supervisor in a company mummified by secrecy. Sure, it helps to have top management support, but even when the top executives play by their own rules and are oblivious to everyone else, you and your people will be more successful and better off working from an open book. When I talk about open book management, I'm talking about the practice of communicating with people via the numbers. I'm not saying open book management is a cure-all for business problems. It may not work at all if you don't do some of the steps mentioned earlier. People aren't going to believe the numbers, and if you haven't established some credibility and began to foster a sense of mutual respect and trust, people aren't going to act on the numbers if they haven't had the experience of winning, if they think of themselves as losers, if they walk around with sand in their eyes. People aren't going to care about the numbers if you haven't given them the sense of the big picture by educating them how the company works, where they fit in, and why it matters. Open book management is the best way I know of to keep people focused on the important issues facing the company. It takes down walls. When you communicate with people through financial statements, knowledge gets to them quickly without being distorted by internal rivalries. If everyone is looking at the whole business, it's much harder for departments to make excuses at another's expense. Production cannot blame sales by saying, "We did our jobs, but those jerks screwed it up." There is a problem and has to be solved. Everybody has to work together to solve it. Maybe production is causing the problem in sales, say by operating behind schedule or letting quality slip. Open book management forces that information to come out it can't hide. Take the emotions out of the business. I know a company that prided itself on its humanistic approach to business. The CEO played motivational tapes and threw regular Friday beer busts to tell people how great they were doing. A terrific corporate culture. But they forgot one thing. You have to make money to stay in business. After a brief but glorious run, the company folded, and the people all lost their jobs. When you have bad news to deliver, the numbers are crucial. It's hard to share bad news. There's a natural fear that people will be discouraged, that they'll give up, that they won't be motivated to solve the problems. But if the message doesn't get through, the problems are only going to get worse. So somehow you want to send the message clearly without getting people down. You can do that with numbers. People hear the message backed by the numbers loud and clear. They say, "Boy, we got to do something about that." There are only two ways to make money in business. One is to be the least cost producer. The other is to have something nobody else has. Unless you have a proprietary product or service, you have to be prepared to compete on price. You can do that best if you're the least cost producer. If you have the lowest costs on the market, you can undersell the competition and still earn a profit. You don't have to worry too much about losing business to competitors who charge less. If your costs are lower, a price war is going to hurt them more than you. On the other hand, it's always nice to be in a position to charge a little more. To do that, you have to come up with an edge customers can't get anywhere else. It can be quality, service, a unique product, or a brand name. As long as you're the only one who has it and customers want it, you can charge a premium for it. The most successful companies strive to have both the lowest cost and something competitors don't have. Many companies manage to develop some combination of the two. In our business, we have to be a low-cost producer because anybody can remanufacture engines and components, and thousands of other companies do. It's essential that we keep our costs down. There is no one individual or department that can do it for us. People throughout the company are constantly making decisions affecting the level of our costs. Every minute of the day, someone on the shop floor decides whether to rework a used part or replace it with a new one. In principle, we want to recycle as many used parts as possible. The more parts we save and reuse, the lower our costs, provided the people don't spend too much time doing their salvage work. Suppose we are paying $26 an hour for labor and overhead, and someone decides to rework a connecting rod, which would cost $45 new. If it takes them 1 hour, the company makes money. If it takes them 2 hours, we lose money. It has to be his judgment call because no two salvage jobs are exactly the same. People constantly have to decide whether it pays to put in the time and effort to do a particular operation. In this way, we are no different from every other business. Cost control happens or doesn't happen on the level of the individual. You don't become the least cost producer by issuing edicts from an office or by setting up elaborate systems of control or by pep talks. The best way to control costs is to enlist everyone in the effort. That means providing people with the tools that allow them to make the right decisions. Those tools are our magic numbers. Every business has them. Specifically, they are numbers that tell you whether or not your costs are lower than your competitors. To know what your costs should be, you have to know what your competitors' costs are, what their labor rates are, how fast they make their products, what fringe benefits they offer, what other incentives they provide, what they pay for material, and what their debt levels are, and so on and so on. Only then can you determine what you must do to be the least cost producer. Your competitors' numbers provide you with your benchmarks. Open book management is the means by which you share those benchmarks with the people in your company, the way you get everyone involved in an effort to become the least cost producer. In the process, you get an additional benefit: a highly motivated workforce with very little turnover and great consistency, which translate into higher quality for the customer. That's something our competitors don't have, something that allows us to charge a little more. Improvements come in fractions. Only surprises come in whole percents. The best argument for open book management is that the more your workforce is educated about the company, the more capable it is of doing the little things required to get better. Business is a game of fractions. If you look at the income statements of corporations today, you'll see that very few have pre-tax margins above 5%. So 1% improvement in profitability is therefore very, very significant, but it takes time to achieve. Surprises, on the other hand, pack the bigger punch. Everybody hates surprises in business. The odd part is that nobody hates surprises more than the manipulative control freaks that practice old-fashioned, secretive, need-to-know management. That way of operating virtually guarantees a steady stream of surprises. This is because people don't have the tools they need to forecast and project and live up to their commitments. To eliminate surprises, you have to be aware of all the factors that limit your ability to deliver what you promise. Consistency lies in the system. It's beyond me, it's beyond you, it's beyond everybody. The system will always be there. Hire law number 6. You can sometimes fool the fans, but you can never fool the players. The great game of business is not a gimmick. If you try to use it as if it were a gimmick, it won't work. Overcoming your fear of disclosure. How do you get to the point where you can even think about creating a democratic workplace? About giving people access to the numbers, and therewith the means to control their destiny? Not by swallowing your pride or admitting that you don't have all the answers and can't make all the decisions. No, it's about swallowing your fear. The great fear number 1. What if our competitors get a hold of your numbers? The notion of opening up the company's books strikes terror in the hearts of many CEOs, who shudder to think that the numbers might fall into the wrong hands, like their competitors. I have to admit, in the beginning, our numbers were so bad, it didn't matter whether or not our competitors saw them. Then, as we began teaching people the numbers, we could see our company get stronger. And so we worried less and less about our competitors because they weren't strengthening themselves in the same way. Imitators never worry me as much as innovators. By sharing the numbers, we were developing something our competitors couldn't match. They could see every single one of our numbers, but unless they adopted our methods, unless they started using their numbers to build morale and motivation, unless they enlisted their own people in the struggle to keep costs down, they weren't going to take us out. This is not to deny that it's possible to use a company's numbers to compete against it. We try to find out all we can about our competitors' numbers. We always buy stock in a competitor that is publicly traded. You'd be foolish not to. The more knowledge you have about a competitor, the easier it is to decide what course of action you should take in a particular situation. When you should compete, when you should back off, where you might have a particular advantage or weakness. It is also true that a company, particularly a private one, can hide certain things. Although a lot less than most people think. For openers, you can get a lot of information from easily accessible sources, such as Dun & Bradstreet and the other credit bureaus. If you compete in the same arena as another company, you're going to find out a lot about it just by being streetwise. When you lose a quote, you can usually figure out why. If you're getting material from the same sources, your material cost should be about the same as your competitors. That leaves labor and overhead. It doesn't take much to find out another company's labor rates. You can ask someone who works there. Or hire somebody from one of your competitors. Then you're down to overhead. So let's say we bid $10 and our competitors or two competitors bid $9 each. It won't take long for us to figure out where we lost the dollar. But the main point is this. In the long run, knowing a competitor's numbers doesn't mean anything unless you are the least cost producer or have something nobody else has. You have to go back to those two basic principles. Yes, a competitor may use our numbers to underbid us on a particular job, but then he has to deliver. He has to provide quality. He has to stand behind the product. Knowing your competitor's financials is at best a short-term tactical advantage, one that pales alongside the benefits that come from educating your employees about the numbers. Besides, it's sometimes better to let your competitor get that particular job or account. If it's very complicated, very costly, or if he's really hot to get it, you almost hope he does. In the first place, he may bid so low that he loses money on it. He may also put himself behind in the race for the next job. So you quote high and hope the other guy wins with a very low bid. The great fear number two. Is it competitors you fear or your own employees? Sad to say, a lot of companies hide their financials not because they're afraid of their competitors, but because they're afraid of their employees. They don't think people will understand the numbers. And there's some truth to that. If you don't show employees how to use financial information as a tool to help the company, they might well use it as a weapon against the company. I still think you're better off in the long run being open with the financial information. When the numbers are hidden, people make assumptions, and they're often crazy ones. 9 times out of 10, people think a company has a lot more money to spend on wages and salaries than it does. They're trained to think big, and they don't understand business. It's amazing, for example, how many people confuse profit with sales. So share the numbers. Even if you don't go the distance in educating your workforce, you won't eliminate all the suspicions people have about your motives or their doubts about the way you run the company. You're not going to get rid of that stupid, ignorant remarks people make when they are not taught what the numbers mean. But at least you avoid some of the wild assumptions people draw when they have no information about the company's real situation. Assumptions that can lead to a very destructive behavior. Great fear number three. What do you reveal if your numbers are bad? The CEO of a screen printing company came up to me after I had given a speech to a business group in California. "I love your message," he said, "and I love the way you run your business, but I could never let my people see all of our numbers. They'd leave if they knew how bad we were really doing." I turned to him and said, "Does that mean you only show them good numbers?" He said, "Yeah, I show them good numbers to keep them motivated." I said, "Do they trust you?" He said, "No." The truth is that you've got to give people the bad as well as the good. It's the only way to build trust, and you must have trust, if only because you're bound to make mistakes. We made a ton of mistakes during our first year as an independent company. I personally lost our biggest customer within 2 weeks of the buyout. Then we got in trouble over a large tax liability we had incurred because we didn't understand the tax laws. Next, we had to cancel our bonus program midway through the year because it wasn't working. Meanwhile, we were barely meeting payroll. People accepted our mistakes and forgave us for them. I think because of the trust we had established during the long period when Harvester was teetering on the brink of bankruptcy and we were trying to buy the factory. Throughout that time, the managers never lost faith, and we asked our people to never lose their faith. Under ridicule, under humiliation, under everything you can possibly imagine, we never lost our composure, and we always told people the truth. I think afterward, they realized we pulled them through a very tough time. So our credibility came more in the face of adversity than in winning. That's a significant point. Too many CEOs only want to share the good numbers. It's a combination of the good and the bad that builds credibility. If you continually make the situation look good, it's a fairy tale. Life's not like that, and people know it. Of course, you lose credibility just as fast if you constantly make the situation look bad in an effort to resist employees' demands. People know life isn't like that. If you want them to believe you, give them the numbers. How to be an open book manager. Sometimes I think what I'm really doing is conducting an orchestra. We have the violins over here, the cymbals there, the wind instruments beyond. My job is to keep the rhythm going. I keep things on schedule, on time. That can be tricky because conditions are always changing. You need to be flexible, but you need structure. What's essential is to make sure that everybody is playing from the same scorecard. Our scorecard is a set of financial statements, notably the income statement and the balance sheet. We mix all kinds of metaphors in explaining those documents to people. I usually tell them that the balance sheet is the company's thermometer. It lets you know whether you're healthy or not. An income statement tells you how you got that way and what you can do about it. For example, a balance sheet may tell you that you have a fever. The income statement tells you what created the fever and what medicine will make the fever go away. You need both. They provide a check and a balance on each other. When you use financial statements as management tools, you have to adapt them to your purposes. Don't rely on the kind of financial statements provided by CPAs. Those statements are designed to give outsiders, investors, tax collectors, bankers, the information they want to know about a company. Employees need something a little different. The general form is the same, and the standards of accuracy should be just as high. But the detail has to be broken down in a way that sheds more light on what's happening inside the company. The point is to show each person how he or she affects the income statement and the balance sheet. You want to report the numbers accordingly, emphasizing the ones over which people have control. How you do that depends entirely on your business. But here are some general rules to follow. Start with the income statement. It is the best tool you have for drawing people into the action of the game because it's constantly changing. As a result, it lends itself to demonstrating cause and effect. You can use it both to monitor the action as it unfolds and to show people their role in determining whether or not the company makes money. Number two, highlight the categories where you spend the most money. Those are obviously the ones that are going to have the biggest impact on your company's profitability, so you want to monitor them very closely. Number three, break down categories into controllable elements. If labor is a variable expense, you want people to see it vary. If you use trucks in your business, people should know how much you're spending there. In a sales organization, you keep a close eye on travel, entertainment, and other selling expenses. In a professional service firm, you probably want to break down billable hours. The whole idea is set up the income statement in a way that lets people observe the effects of what they do. Number four, use the income statement to educate people about the balance sheet. While the action may center around the income statement, it is the balance sheet that tells you the real score, how secure jobs are, how wealth has been created, where the company's vulnerable. You ignore it at your peril. Once they get the hang of the income statement, it's a fairly simple matter to show them how the changes they produce change the balance sheet. Use the same principle of breaking down large balance sheet categories to illuminate cause and effect. Above all, develop a set of financial statements that works for your particular business. If you have a chain of clothing stores, your internal statements will wind up looking very different from those you would develop if you had a travel agency or a hair salon or a consulting firm or a metal fabrication business. But the process by which you would come up with your statements would not vary that much at all. At SRC, we break out the various costs involved in manufacturing operation. Typically, these costs would be lumped together in the cost of goods line on the income statement. That may be adequate for a banker, but it doesn't tell us very much about what really is going on in production, where most of our people work. We want them to see exactly what effect they are having on profits, so we break down the cost of goods sold into the basic elements: material, labor, and overhead. Every week, the various departments forecast whether and by how much they're going to be over or under budget for the month. Then after the month's close, we produce a 100-page set of financial statements showing exactly what happened where and how each person contributed. Almost every element of the company is quantified, from the percentage of the budget spent on receptionist notepads to the amount of overhead absorbed each hour that a person puts in grinding crankshafts. We constantly measure material costs, overhead, performance, hourly rates. Labor ratios are calculated on a daily basis by supervisors, group leaders, department managers, the hourly people themselves. There are numbers for everybody, even the person who buys pencils, cleaning fluid, and the like. Every day, she punches her receipts in the computer, which matches them up against the standard cost file and gives her a printout. From that, she can see whether her actual purchases have been favorable or unfavorable to standard. That is, whether she's over or under budget. This happens all over the company. Sales numbers are posted daily. Who's buying, what they're buying, how they're buying. The numbers are broken down, not just by customer, but by product. Meanwhile, on the shop floor, there's a constant flurry of move tickets telling stories of their own. Say a guy finishes 10 engines. He would move them from his station to the warehouse, and a move ticket would go along. That ticket is punched to show the unit is now complete. Once the work order is finished, we'll calculate whether the product made money or lost money. Visitors sometimes find all this a little overwhelming. I tell them to bear in mind that we didn't create this system overnight. It took us years to develop all the mechanisms we now have for keeping people up to date on the numbers, and we're still coming up with new ones. But we started out very simply. In the first year, our chief financial officer would chicken scratch a daily report to the bank showing where our cash was, where our inventories were, where our receivables were, what we owed, and so on. That would be passed around the company. People got curious. They would come down to the front office in the morning and ask, "What do we owe today?" From there, the reporting system just grew and grew. It expanded because people kept asking for more information. They didn't need an MBA to be curious about what was going on. Many of them had not even graduated from high school. But that didn't stop them from getting caught up in the game. The more information we provided, the more they wanted to know. Do you know how much your toilet paper costs? You undoubtedly heard the time-honored management maxim, "Don't sweat the small stuff." It's the worst advice a business can follow. We sweat everything, although it took a little inspiration to get some of our costs under control. By the end of our second year as an independent company, we had a budget system in place, but we were having problems with the minute costs of the business that were not directly related to making the product. Everything from toilet paper to paint to protective eyeglasses to heating and lighting. We hadn't been monitoring these so-called burden costs, and the spending was getting out of control. So we said, we'll divide the burden items up and give one account to each of the supervisors and other management people. It would be that person's responsibility to determine how big the budget item should be, not just for his or her particular area, but for the whole company, and then to make sure that we hit the target. The idea was to give ownership of the burden numbers to specific individuals. Before, nobody owned the numbers. The burden expenses were being dumped into a catch-all category in the budget process. Having these catch-alls turned out to be a big mistake. If you have a catch-all in a budget, people will dump anything and everything into it. The results were that people spent whatever they felt like on burden items and the expenses went wild. So we wrote the names of the burden items on slips of paper and put all the slips into a pot. Then we got together and did a drawing. Each person drew an account with a dollar figure attached. A guy named Don Wood got toilet paper. After we finished the drawing, we told people to go out and do some investigating, then come back to the next meeting prepared to say whether or not they accepted the dollar figures we had put down. If not, they had to say why not and tell us what the actual figure should be. As it turned out, some people stuck with the number we gave them. Some lowered it, and some raised it. We didn't really care, so long as we bought into the final figure, because from then on, it would be each person's responsibility to follow that account and bring it home. Don Wood took the assignment to heart. As he tracked toilet paper account, he began to notice certain surprising but unmistakable trends. You would think, after all, that toilet paper consumption would remain more or less constant from week to week or month to month. But that wasn't the case. Instead, there was a distinct pattern of variations. Being a curious guy, Wood began looking into factors that might cause a rise or a dip in toilet paper use. Sure enough, he discovered that the more time people spent working on Prime, which is actually producing engines and engine components, the less toilet paper they used. At a staff meeting, Wood presented his findings in the form of a graph on which he plotted toilet paper consumption in 1983 and 1984, along with the number of prime hours worked during each month of the period. He thereby demonstrated beyond dispute that the busier we were, the less frequently we went to the bathroom. Aside from providing ongoing entertainment, the program worked. Don Wood came in under budget, and so did most of the other burden item tractors. Their spirit was contagious. That was the year we went after overhead in the bonus program. At the beginning of the year, we had a charge-out rate of $39 per hour, meaning that we spent $39 of overhead for every hour we worked on Prime. The bonus goal was to reduce the charge-out rate to $32.50 per hour. In fact, we got it down to $26.32 per hour. Our profits soared, since every penny we took out of overhead went straight to the bottom line, and the value of our stock soared from 61 cents a share to $4.05 per share. Somehow I don't think it was pure coincidence that all this happened the same year Don Wood came up with his toilet paper index. Employees wanted to see exactly where they fit into the process, how much money they were saving the company, how much profit they had generated on a particular job, what their ups and downs were, how well a particular idea had worked. Their questions told us what information we should be reporting. Management's role was to instill the desire to know. We did that by a variety of methods, through the bonus system, the weekly meetings, and all the games we developed along the way. But the process got started as simply as can be, by sitting down and explaining to people how the bank was measuring us and how we were doing. The system is so damn logical. It takes the whole element of direct supervision out of managing. You don't have to pound a person over the head because he or she doesn't want to work. You pound them over the head because they're missing opportunities that could put money in their pockets. It's a totally different style of management. You can communicate by pointing to the opportunities that are out there rather than by using threats and intimidation. It's a way to motivate people without lying to them or deceiving them. It's motivation with realism.